Accession number 11522, reel 4.
Dennis Allen, reel 4.
Reel 4.
Nothing that's happened in the last 50 years has deflected me from that, and I think everything that has happened has confirmed me in it. So I still adopt the same position, basically. But whether I would go through with it to the extent I did, I can't predict.
What date would it have been?
I came out in June 42, and I went back for 2 or 3 months to the Arches at Charing Cross, and then I went to Stepney. Do you want this, do you? I mean, are we talking now?
Yes. Yes. No, that's fine. Okay. Yes, I would like to know about your experience with the youth. This was the job which you were permitted to do by the tribunal, but which you elected to do yourself.
It was a job. I mean, the tribunal permitted me to do any job in social work, which was very broad. It gave them reason to exempt me without putting any pressure on me. It was an accommodating arrangement, and I was determined to do social work anyway, so there was no conflict. And I certainly wouldn't have desisted from social work just to spite them. I wasn't that degree extremist. I'd been asked to, a friend of mine asked me to go and do this thing. It was a Quaker organisation in East London, and my first wife and I then went there and spent 4 years there until 1946 running this youth club. A very happy time, and we'd lived in lots of different places in London, but nowhere we enjoyed and valued as much as Stepney. It was such a loving and warm community. It was immense poverty, of course, and terrible overcrowding and all the rest, and the aftermath of the Blitz and then the V1 and the V2 bombs and rockets and all that. But such a close-knit community, which was virtually destroyed after the war by rehousing when families were separated from their extended families and sent out to Essex and various places. And it's very sad subsequently to go back and see Stepney and Bethnal Green come to that. But those were very rewarding days, and we enjoyed it and got a lot out of it, and maintained contacts there long after we left.
Yes, you were saying about these COs that you met in the war. You know, we were talking informally,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered if you would care to give a few cases of people you knew. Such as your sculptor.
Well, this man, Arnold Machin by name, who was a sculptor working with Wedgwoods.
How do you spell that?
M-A-C-H-I-N. We used to call him, our nickname for him was Le Machin. He was a lovely man. And he came to us because he was a pacifist, and he had been working at a unit down in West Ham somewhere. And he'd been given the job of building a blast wall at a shelter. And the first time anybody had leant against it, it had fallen down. And my friend who had told me about the youth club job, who was running this unit, asked, could we take him on? And I thought, well, he is an artist and a very skilled man. And it might be a good idea to have him at the club. He was the most ethereal man I have ever seen, with a bald dome of head and ringlets, long ringlets coming down over his ears to his shoulders. And he wore sandals and corduroys, you know, the traditional artist image of those days. And I looked at him when he came, and I thought, oh, goodness, our youth club kids are really going to take the mickey out of this guy. But we said we'll take him, so let's take him. Well, the first night he came down to the club with us, he just took his materials, and he took not the slightest notice of any youngsters or of me or anybody. He just sat in a room and got out his paint pot and so on and started drawing and painting. And by the end of the evening, one or two kids had gone in and looked over his shoulder, and he'd just gone on ignoring them. By the end of the week, they were eating out of his hand. He was a brilliant man, and they loved him, and they respected him, because they could see his quality as an artist. And he ran the most successful class we've had for a long, long time now. And then, of course, came his time to go to prison. He was fairly inarticulate, I think. I mean, he would talk all right with us, but put him on a public platform, and he would curl up. But he was so genuine. And, of course, the tribunal didn't believe that and wouldn't exempt him and sentenced him to 12 months. He wouldn't appeal against the sentence. He did his 8 months, two-thirds. We got his third in remission at Wormwood Scrubs. And the day for him to come out, my wife had laid on a rather special breakfast for him to welcome him and so on. And he came in and through the front door. Rita said, "Here we are, super breakfast." And he just looked at her. He was friendly, right? He said, "No, thanks, I'll just have cornflakes." And finished his breakfast and went up to his room and started painting. And it, just as though prison hadn't intervened at all. It was just as though it was yesterday he'd gone to bed upstairs and here he was the next morning. I've never known anybody so able to fence off an area of his life as of no importance whatever to him. And he was like that. And I've known other artists who, you know, approach that capacity, which I think is admirable. He was a lovely man. And I've known other people equally inarticulate, but absolutely genuine, who weren't exempted because they couldn't demonstrate that they had arrived at their position by logic. Only logic would count. And even if it was suspect, if it looked reasonable on paper, then you could get exemption. If you couldn't argue that case, then you weren't conscientious.
Yes, it goes back to your opinion, doesn't it?
Yes.
That you know how difficult it is to judge someone's conscience.
That's right.
You know, your original
That's
thought
right.
about the tribunal.
That's right. It's something between you and your own God, I think. And I, it's not possible. I mean, I understand the state, if it's going to exempt people, it needs to set up some system to determine who and who not should be exempted. I see the point. But I declare it an impossibility.
Do you come to any conclusion about pacifism and social class? You know, whether one social class is over or underrepresented?
Generally speaking, working class people are underrepresented in the pacifist movement, which isn't to say there are none. There are some very able and active ones. But generally speaking, it's the pacifist ethos is nurtured in different circumstances. Though I must say, it wasn't nurtured in my family background at all, which was military. So I was a kind of... you always get rebels anyway, in all families of all classes. I mean, the Quakers, I have to say, in this country, they're not always, not in all overseas countries, in this country, we're much more middle-class and working-class organisation.
Do you think it's anything to do with education as well? Would that be a factor in some cases?
Well, I think so. The thing is, it depends what kind of education you get, not necessarily what subjects you learn, and how diverse the syllabus is, all that, but whether the education you get is aimed at not imparting knowledge, but encouraging development, intellectual, emotional, moral development. That seems to me to be the basic purpose of education, not equipping people to fit in a slot, to be an economic unit in adult society. I mean, that obviously plays its part. But for many people, that is now the main focus of education. And I think that's so sad because it deflects education from the issue of values, the kinds of values that children need to acquire, and acquire from them for themselves, not to be indoctrinated with. And they only acquire it for themselves if they're given inquiring, if if they're given encouragement to what are naturally inquiring minds in young children and are not stifled and are liberated. So I can't remember what sparked me off onto that, but that seems to me an essential feature. And that's, yes, I now remember, in a sense that helps determine the breeding ground for pacifist thought, or for any really genuine thought about social relationships. It didn't lead to pacifism. It can lead in other directions, but it is thought about one's relationships with one's fellow men and women, of course.
Yes. Did you meet many women pacifists, you know, in the war?
My sister-in-law was one. She did it the hard way. She joined the ATS and then defected.
But was she able to do that quite easily?
Quite easily, and they didn't worry. I don't think even at that stage she became pregnant. That came later. I don't know that there was a general feeling that the equality of the sexes demanded that women were treated in the same kind of way as men during the Second World War. But there was a reluctance to be beastly to them, because they didn't know how the women would react anyway. They were capable of being much more difficult than men. And so rather than have a great schmozzle, I think if women dug their heels in, generally speaking, people didn't. The official world didn't pursue them. Obviously, there were exceptions.
Do you consider yourself still to be a pacifist?
Yes, I certainly do. I must say, I'm not as active in the pacifist movement as I was when younger. I used to go and sell Peace News, Marvel Arch, and all that. And I used to run. I used to take one of these platforms to run open-air meetings in the lunch hour and organise speakers and so on. I don't do that anymore. I've joined in pacifist vigils from time to time and so on. And, of course, I talk about pacifism when I get the opportunity.
Public. And you can't. Do you do it publicly?
Very seldom. And not on the issue of pacifism as such. No, I don't do that. What I have done, I mean, I travel a lot, and I talk about it in Europe. My wife and I have a camper, and we get around. We spent time in East Europe, in East Germany and Hungary and Romania and places before freedom began to rear its ugly head there. But the earliest contact I had was in 1972. We went over to Munich for the Olympic Games. At least I did. My wife just reluctantly dragged herself along and sat by a lakeside while I watched the athletics. There we met a German family, middle-aged couple with two older teenage children, who befriended us and were charming. And we're still in touch with them now. We visit them still. And he'd served in the German army during the war, and I explained my position, why I hadn't served in the British army. And they found that strange. I remember we had lots of conversations, and he corrected me on a number of things. I mean, he was a German patriot, but an internationalist. Now, I mean, and I was saying things like, the only hope for the future of the world is if men and women become a bit more moral in their attitudes and their actions. And he said, heaven forbid, they have to become wiser. And it was interesting, because the Latin for human is homo sapiens, which means wisdom. I don't know what homo means, man wise. And that struck me, because he then went on to talk about all these people, including Hitler and so on, who claim morality and that they're acting in the name of morality. And it can be so easily perverted. Mm. And so can goodness seemingly be, you see. And this was a very interesting communication across a great divide, really, because his wartime experience was so totally different. And he'd done his own thinking. He'd come to this kind of conclusion, and that impressed me enormously. But so it led us to talk about pacifism and things like that. And the young, his son, who was then about 17, took part in the conversation. Years later, when we went back on a second visit, and the young man is now 30, or was when we were there last time, and we hadn't seen him on subsequent visits because by then the youngsters had grown up and left home, and we only visited the parents. But he was there for a family reunion when we went back, I don't know, about 1985, 6, something like that. And he came in. He came in for an evening meal with us, and he said, "Oh yes, I remember you. And I remember what you said about pacifism, and it prompted me to refuse military service in Germany when my time came." And he'd found some way of exemption. I don't know what it was. And I was delighted, of course. I was very fond of them all anyway. But he showed no inclination. He'd debated it as a matter of interest when he was 17. But he'd given no indication that he would think that way. And I don't suppose he had thought that way until that time. But it was very interesting to find that kind of bread cast on the waters flowing back years later. So I was pleased with that. I mean, and I think that in a way, I mean, it is important that people get together in organisations and try to promote the peace movement, of course. And I belong to CND and so on, and as a Quaker I do. But I think it's no less important for individuals to meet as individuals across the international boundaries and to be talking in the same way and forming relationships which make warfare between them as individuals impossible. And in fact, the opening up to travel now makes that much more of a reasonable possibility to achieve, provided we all approach travel with the same end in view.
Yes, because I'm often struck, you know, talking to people about the war, you know, people who fought as well as anti-war, how much contact there was with Germany.
Yes.
You know, the number of people who were there on holiday just before it broke out.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
It didn't seem to have prevented that war.
That's right. Well, just the mere contact alone, I think, is not sufficient. It's got to be developed on a relationship of positive peacemaking, really, which doesn't have to be all achieved in words, but by attitudes and so on. I mean, this is not quite the same, but we were in East Germany in 1987, before the Berlin Wall or anything like it, and we were camping outside Leipzig, and three East German youths came to admire our camper and ask about it and so on, and we got in conversation. And I always like to try to be optimistic, how pessimistic one feels. And I was saying to these three, well, I mean, it's marvellous for me, this is my first visit to East Germany and so on. What about you? When do you think you will be able to come to England? And they just shrugged and said, "Oh, never." And so I said, "Not in 5 years' time, perhaps?" And they said, "No, no way." "Well, 10 years, I said. And then, more to humour me than out of any real belief, they said, "Well, maybe in 10 years. But if you talk like that with people, they don't forget it. And the weight of collective individual opinions begin to have effect communally. And I think now of those three, and I wonder if they recall that conversation. And I'd love it. We didn't exchange addresses, but we have done with some. I wonder whether they now think, good, we can go to England. But it's just that kind of... I do think you can act positively as an individual abroad. You don't have to be in an organisation, though that also helps.
But going back to organisations, CND you belong to...
Yes.
Is that a pacifist organisation?
No, it's not. No, no. And he mentioned it en passant. I didn't join it for a long time, but I've joined it out of a feeling of solidarity with the objectives. Now, I'm less active now than I was. I do more on this kind of individual stuff, which gives me more pleasure, I must admit.
Yes, it's more anti-bomb, isn't it, than anti-war?
Yes, that's right, that's right. It's not anti-war. Well, a lot of people in the CND movement are anti-war also. But the organisation doesn't exist for that purpose.
When you look at the future, or, you know, our present, the state of the world, you know, do you feel optimistic?
You feel optimistic and for a bit until you get a kind of Iraq eruption. And you have to acknowledge that whatever the outcome of this one, it won't be the last eruption of a like kind around the world. Everyone accepts that. I remember when I joined the Quakers, I was interviewed by a couple of well-established, well-elderly friends and so on, and which you have to do, you know, to make sure that you're the kind of person who... You know, who fits in, whose beliefs are of a kind, of a like kind. One of them asked me, did I believe in the second coming? And I said, well, I believe in the ultimate arrival of the kingdom of heaven on earth. I now have to say I don't. I think the earthly kingdom will always be imperfect. Because we are all imperfect, and there will always be these eruptions. But I am optimistic in the light of my friend Ferdinand in Regensburg, who said, "We have to learn to be wiser." I think that is possible, provided our wisdom is thought of as genuine wisdom, not just technical proficiency. That is very scarifying.
Yes, I wonder how you are reacting to events in the Middle East at the moment, and the American force that's been sent. You know, can you see that situation being coped with apart from a stand like that?
I find that very difficult. But in principle, well, indeed, almost in practice, it's very similar to the Hitler eruption, and people have made that connection. And for myself, my stand would be the same as it was then, 50 years ago. I quite recognise that, again, current logic would say we mustn't allow Saddam to do the conquests by stealth which Hitler achieved before unleashing the Second World War. That's a very powerful argument, I see that. But if summoned, if the state required me to be conscripted into service of some kind or another in that war, I should still refuse. Which may be thought, I would feel it in a sense, a cop out, but it's one of these situations where I can do no other.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much indeed for sharing your pacifist experience with me today. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to add just a short passage about one of the things that appealed to me most about the Quakers, and that is their attitude and assumption of total equality between men and women. As I expect you know, Quakers don't have ordained priests or any such. They rely upon internal ministry from all the members of the society to each other, women no less than men, so that positions of responsibility in the society are shared equally by women and men. And the pioneers in the early days who went to America and who suffered martyrdom and penal laws forbidding dissent were just as much women as men. And all the current talk about the difficulties of recognising women as priests in the Anglican Church, and in, even more so in the Catholic Church, of course, leave me cold. They seem to me so unchristian and so fixated on the idea of a male God. And this isn't my idea of God at all. And the components of women in the idea of God are so critical and to us all. And indeed, the more so, the more violent we become, the more capable of violence we become because of our technological abilities with each other. There are certain female components which are to do with love and the expression of love in a particular way, which males are seldom capable of. Now, if you eliminate from that from your notion of God and talk about a sainted Holy Mary up there, who is not really part of God, then you're getting so far away from the Christianity that Jesus was talking about, it seems to me. I know so many Quaker women whom I admire and respect, and there have been so many Quaker heroines over the centuries, that that's one of the things that differentiates Quakers from any other religious group that I know of from the 17th century onwards. Certainly there's much more moves to equality nowadays, but even in 1939 when I joined society, churches were extraordinarily male-dominated.
Thank you.
Okay.